Hello and welcome to the Respiratory Essentials podcast. My name's Naomi. I'm a respiratory nurse specialist and healthcare professional engagement manager here at Asthma and Lung UK. This is the very first episode in our new series designed to support primary care clinicians from across all professional backgrounds who look after patients living with a lung condition. Over the coming weeks, we're going to take you through the brilliant basics, how to get it right for your patients, and how you can feel more confident in understanding and applying the latest guidelines. Everything we talk about here is also available on our Healthcare Professionals Hub, which has a whole range of written guidance, tools to support your practice, and patient information resources as well. You'll also find some suggestions on where you can go to get some more training to increase your skills and your confidence. Today's episode is part of a two-part series on asthma. We're starting with assessment and diagnosis in both adults and children. Then in our next episode, we're going to focus on managing asthma and putting those guidelines into practice. I am delighted to be joined by our clinical lead, Dr. Andy Whittemore, who's going to walk us through how we should be using the joint guidelines published last year to make sure that we're recognising asthma, assessing it and diagnosing it correctly. Andy, thank you for being here today. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Thanks for having me on for this. It's really, really good to talk about this topic.
Oh, it's a pleasure. As well as your role as clinical lead for the charity, you're a GP. So I imagine you see a lot of patients with asthma or suspected asthma. Can I start out by asking you about the new guidelines? They've been out for almost a year, haven't they? But for lots of us, they still feel quite new. What do you think these guidelines mean for the future of asthma care?
These guidelines have been something that we've been waiting for a long time. So in the UK, we've had NICE guidelines and then BTS signed guidelines, and they haven't quite aligned, which has made it confusing, especially for people new to respiratory, to know exactly what to do for their patients. So the fact that all the organisations got together and have come up with one single guideline has made it simpler. And that is a great stepping stone that allows us to do better for our patients and to be more certain and confident in what we're doing. There's still a few things to sort of catch up with. I mean, even though the guidelines came out right at the end of 2024, QoF, which is how GP practices in England are paid, didn't really get updated till April this year. And then we've got all the contracting stuff in the background in England as well, which means that devices like Pheno and spirometry aren't available for everybody at the moment. So I think there's still a lot more to do, and Asthma Lung UK are fighting to try and get these things moved forward. But this guideline is a great stepping stone for us to know what to do for our patients.
Yeah, I agree. And so where do we start as clinicians? What would you advise us to do when we have got a patient in front of us and we suspect that they might have asthma?
So one really big thing about these NICE guidelines is they've placed a real emphasis on the importance of a good clinical history. Even though the previous guidelines were really good at saying take a good clinical history of your patient, when we sort of looked at what the algorithm said, we'd often print up the diagram which told us which tests to do. This whole approach to the NICE guidelines are based on you thinking that your patient has got asthma based on a good clinical history. So for anybody who comes in who's got features that could be asthma, ask lots of questions, be inquisitive, try and find out as much about those symptoms as possible. Not just what the symptoms are and when they happen, but what might be setting them off, what might make them better, and over time, do they change? So I think just asking as much as you can about those symptoms and how they're affecting the patient in front of you is absolutely crucial. One thing we know is that chest symptoms are very common. We all cough. We all get breathless. And there's lots of other conditions out there which can cause cough, breathlessness, wheeze, and tightness in the chest. So it's very easy to jump in and get it wrong. So we need to ask a really good set of questions of our patients to get as much detail as possible to find out about their cough, their wheeze, any tightness in the chest, any breathlessness. When is it worst? What makes it worse? Are there specific times of day or the year that their symptoms seem to be causing the problems? Are there specific places, so work or a particular house or some place in the country that always seems to set off their symptoms? So what does make it worse? What does seem to make it better? And then you sort of add that into things like Have they got a family history or a past medical history of asthma or any allergies such as hay fever and eczema? Those sorts of things all come together like a bit of a jigsaw to help us try and identify whether somebody might have asthma or not. And I don't think the other thing about taking a good clinical history, especially with asthma and respiratory problems, is looking at what else could be causing those symptoms. So asking about ENT problems like rhinitis, like postnasal drip, asking about risk factors and symptoms that might suggest COPD, gastric reflux, anxiety, heart issues. And that can, again, either take you towards thinking somebody's got asthma, or are there other things you need to be thinking of, about? And of course, people can have more than one condition at the same time. Just because somebody has smoked for 20 years and are likely to have COPD doesn't mean they haven't got asthma or another condition as well. And certainly, I think you've already said this, on the Hub, there's some really great guides for people. So go along there, take some time to read through the different web pages. They'll give you an idea of the sort of questions and conditions to be asking about.
And on the Hub, those structured assessments are ready and waiting for you, just giving you prompts of what you need to ask while you get into the swing of that assessment process. And Andy, do we code our patients as suspected asthma at this point, or should we wait until we do some testing?
So this is something I've done for a long time, is actually put suspected asthma on the codes. And that's partly because asthma is so variable, people might not get symptoms again for weeks, months, or even years. So having that code on the notes allows you to find it and go back to where you were thinking what might be going on. And especially as there's now so many more people working in primary care, I don't unfortunately get to follow up every one of my patients individually. They might well be seen by our nurse or our pharmacist or somebody else within the team. And it's important that those other members of the team can actually understand what I was thinking, that we were thinking that this person might have asthma, and be able to get them back on track for the diagnostic pathway at the right time.
So the suspected asthma code acts as a place marker while you think about your next steps, is that right?
Especially because it's so variable, and to say you might not see that patient for a long time, or somebody else might end up seeing them. But the other thing I say, not just in my case, but for all the people I work with, is document absolutely everything. The positive bits of the history, the negative bits of the history, any thoughts or suspicions you might have about what's causing their symptoms. That can be really useful, not just for your own thinking going forward, but actually when somebody else picks up the case or sees somebody and tries to sort of work out what your thought process was and why you think that person might have asthma.
I often think that future you is always very grateful when you go back and see a really thorough clinical history to support your next steps with a patient with asthma.
Also saves me a lot of time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we've completed a thorough history. What do we need to do next, Andy, in terms of testing? Let's start off with adult patients.
So the way I tend to look at things is, as I remind myself, that asthma is a variable condition. It comes and goes. It depends on those triggers causing the symptoms. And those symptoms are caused by either inflammation or airflow obstruction or both. And they're the sort of two things that we try and find evidence for. So people who have got symptoms at the time are likely to have higher levels of inflammation or higher degrees of obstruction. So testing somebody when they've got symptoms is a really important opportunity. And this guideline really helps us to identify the acute presentation as a really good opportunity to find out whether somebody has asthma, if it's behaving like asthma. So as well as taking a good clinical history, if somebody is presenting to me in a duty clinic or to one of my colleagues, we can be doing tests to identify either the inflammation or the obstruction. So in terms of inflammation, we can be arranging a blood test for eosinophil count. And this is sort of a new thing for many of us in the respiratory field. It feels a little bit alien to be arranging a blood test, but it's actually a really good opportunity to find out whether they've got a raised eosinophil count, which then supports the history, and you can then diagnose them. Being able to get somebody to blow into a pheno machine is an equally good opportunity. So it can, again, pick up evidence of the inflammation while they've got symptoms. If either of those aren't available, or if you prefer, then actually acutely, you can be doing spirometry with reversibility or peak flow before and after bronchodilation. And again, these are valid methods within the NICE algorithm for actually proving that somebody you think has got asthma has got asthma. In reality, though, we don't pick up that many patients that way. We tend to pick them up in our respiratory clinics after a period of time when their symptoms aren't quite so acute. And that is exactly why the NICE algorithm talks about going from one test to the next test and to the next test until you get one positive test. Because one positive test is good enough to diagnose asthma in somebody where there's a good clinical history. So the first thing that the NICE wants us to do is to test for inflammation. And that is either eosinophil count or FeNO. You don't need to do both. One or the other is good enough. If one of those tests come back positive, then you can diagnose asthma. You can recode them asthma. You can start them on a management pathway. If the test is negative, but you've still got a history that makes you think they probably do have asthma, then you should move on to a test for obstruction. And the two ways that it suggests, well, the first way is actually doing spirometry with reversibility. If that isn't available, or in your area where there's a very long wait for spirometry, then the guideline does support you to do a peak flow diary for 2 weeks in that patient. It's not the preferred option. It prefers testing for inflammation or doing spirometry, but you have got peak flow as a backup where you haven't got those tests. It's a very clear algorithm where you're looking to come up with one positive test in someone who you think has got a good history suggestive of asthma.
Great. So just to be clear, we can now make a secure diagnosis based on just one test. We can start off with blood eosinophils, FeNO if we have it, and if we don't have either of those, we can move to spirometry and think about peak flow.
That's absolutely correct. And one of the really important things that this guideline worked on was the certainty of those tests. So previous guidelines have looked at whether the tests on their own are good at diagnosing asthma. And as a result, the previous guidelines have been saying use two or more ways of actually diagnosing asthma. These guidelines have really simplified it. If you've taken a really good clinical history, you think this person has got asthma, you only need one of those tests to actually hit the threshold for you to actually add the diagnosis to a patient's records.
This sounds so straightforward. Is that how it really is in the real world, Andy?
It makes it more simple because we only have to do the one test, and there were lots of confusions that popped up with the previous guidelines. But having a single test that's positive in somebody with a good clinical history really places the emphasis on taking a good history. There are lots of people we think have got asthma, but we can't prove it. And this just makes that easier. The difficulty is the availability of some of those tests. We're not used to doing a blood test for asthma. So that's a new thing that we have to start thinking about and doing tests for eosinophils. We don't all have a FeNO machine, but they are coming. We are all getting better access to these tests. And that is the big game changer in adults and for children. And spirometry, we all need to have available. And it's a really good way of actually diagnosing somebody as having asthma.
I know a lot of people really struggle with having access to FeNO or spirometry. And do you have any advice for people who are struggling with that in their practice?
It is difficult. And as I say, in our practice, we haven't had FeNO over recent years, and that's been a big issue for us. But that's coming. And as I say, we're all very excited to have it. When you do have FeNO, it is a game changer for adults and children in coming up with diagnosis, but also monitoring through the NICE guidelines as well, it's recommended. But where it's not available, the guidelines have been quite pragmatic and suggested if you haven't got proof of inflammation from either the eosinophil count or FeNO because you don't have it, and you haven't been able to do spirometry at least quickly on a patient, then doing a peak flow diary is an acceptable way of doing it. It's not the first line, it's not our first choice. But if that's all you've got, that's what you should be doing.
Thank you. And again, if you could have a look over on the hub, we have included links to writing a business plan for FeNO in your own practice, which you might find useful if that's what you're trying to achieve. My next question, Andy, is one that comes up so often. What happens if my clinical history really suggests that patient has asthma, but their test results don't support that diagnosis? What do I do next?
Well, there's different reasons why that might have happened. Firstly, you might be catching them when their disease isn't so active. And that in that case, either the inflammation or the obstruction isn't so easy to pick up. The second reason is actually, even though the history might suggest asthma, there are lots of conditions out there that look and sound and act like asthma. It's really important that we make sure that we're not treating somebody for something they don't have. The guidelines are quite clear here that if you've sort of been through the test for inflammation and for airflow obstruction, then you should be referring them to secondary care for bronchial challenge test. Unfortunately, this isn't easily available and there are waiting times for secondary care. So what we're doing locally is if we've got a very clear history and so far the tests have come up negative, we've done what we call an advice and guidance to our local specialists. And that's been a really good way of actually getting an opinion or support for a next stage for that patient. And there's been different things that our specialists have recommended. But based on the clinical history you've taken, the likelihood of it being asthma, the likelihood of it not being something else, having that specialist support is really key to actually making you make that right decision or getting them the right tests in secondary care.
And I think what you're really identifying there is that if your patient isn't symptomatic, you're not necessarily going to get a positive test if it's taken on that day.
Exactly. But there's also things that we can't test for, like breathing pattern disorders and gastric reflux and other things like that, which if you take the history, you might pick up hints towards it. But actually, they do act and sound a lot like asthma do.
It's a real jigsaw, isn't it, putting this asthma diagnosis together. So we need to be thinking about that really strong history, the correct tests, and then if those tests aren't positive, thinking outside the box about what else it could be.
Exactly right.
So once, let's say we have got that secure diagnosis, so we've put together the clinical picture with positive tests, can you tell me what the patient's notes should look like? What should I see before me if I'm new to that patient's record?
So at this point, I've got a really good detailed history. I've now got one single test which proves the person has got asthma. I will document and read code that they have asthma as a diagnosis. I'll be jotting down what tests have been positive. And most of the GPIT systems have got really good templates. So you can tick the right box which show whether it was eosinophil count or FeNO, spirometry or peak flow. And you can sort of document what exactly the test has found. I would also sort of highlight the main points of the history. Sometimes I actually just refer myself back to my suspected asthma history taking. But if I've proven it, then sometimes I do sort of reiterate the main points of the history that have made me suspect it was asthma, the main triggers, the things that I've identified that do set them off. And if there's any other conditions that might well be acting like asthma or aggravating the asthma as well. I think the important thing is actually making sure the patient understands why I've made that clinical decision, why I think they've got asthma, what the tests mean, and help them to understand more about their condition. I can't do that in 10, 20 minutes. So what I generally do is actually send them links to the Asthma in Lung UK website. There's some great bits on there that they can read through. There's YouTube clips and all sorts they can use to try and clue themselves up on not just their condition, but things they can do to stay well.
Thank you. And that's what we're going to be talking about next time, isn't it, Andy, about taking the patient onto their management journey following their diagnosis. Andy, that's adults. Let's move on to our child patients, the 5 to 16-year-olds. And then later on, we'll talk about the preschoolers. So for this school age group, what tests can we perform in primary care to support our clinical history and help us make a diagnosis?
For some reason, we're all scared of making diagnosis or missing a diagnosis of asthma in children. But actually, I keep going back to those same principles I've already talked about. Take a really good clinical history. So you're looking for things that support you proving from their symptoms and their triggers and what makes them better, what makes them worse, so that you can be confident that you can say this person's got suspected asthma. You're also asking lots of questions where you then try to identify other causes of those symptoms, whether that's reflux or there's something else going on in the background that you need to be considering. But where you do think it's asthma, then you get them back onto that algorithm. You're testing for evidence of either inflammation or obstruction. And once again, you only need one test to be positive. Because you've taken a really good history, you can be confident that one test confirms your thoughts, confirms your theories. Because we're looking at children, though, there's a slightly different way that we apply those tests. So firstly, the evidence around FeNO is much stronger in children. So actually, for inflammation, FeNO is the first line test. We should be trying to do FeNO where it's available on any child that we suspect has got asthma. If it isn't available, or if the test comes back lower than the threshold, then we should move on to a test for obstruction. And that would be doing spirometry on your child. Again, NICE have been very kind to us. And if we haven't got spirometry available, or if the child can't do spirometry, then a 2-week peak flow diary is another valid way of diagnosing asthma. And again, any one positive test from those is enough to come up with confirmation of your suspicion that they've got asthma. The thing that's slightly more different with children, just to sort of bear in mind, is that if you've done spirometry or peak flow and it hasn't proven asthma, but you still think there's asthma, then it would be reasonable to arrange skin prick testing, if you've got it available, to house dust mite. Because again, a positive house dust mite test in somebody with a positive history of asthma can confirm that they've got that condition. Or an alternative to the skin prick test would be a blood test for eosinophil count and IgE. And again, if the IgE is raised and the eosinophil count is above 0.5, then together that confirms asthma.
Can I ask about blood tests in these younger children? These children who can't manage breathing tests, or whose tests are negative even when their history is very strong. Sometimes healthcare professionals worry a bit and wonder if it's fair to take bloods, because it can be obviously an invasive procedure for small children, and parents quite often get worried about it too. When should blood testing be part of the diagnostic pathway, and how do we balance it, its usefulness against whether it's fair on the child?
I think firstly to say that the NICE guideline suggests we do non-invasive tests first. So we do the pheno test, we do spirometry or peak flow if that's what's available. And then we've got the option of doing blood tests or skin prick tests if that's important. I think it varies from child to child and parent to parent, actually. I've got some parents who would prefer a blood test because they see it as more valuable or more definitive in coming up with other diagnoses. So they sort of recognise that it could have a value here. And others who are very keen that their child doesn't have a needle put in their arm. So it's always worth asking the question. I think if you've got a child or a parent who is absolutely refusing the blood test, then it's valid to sort of document that, and maybe then you move on to the stage where you're doing advice and guidance to one of the consultants to see what they would do in this circuit situation. So I think it's important to know that the blood test is an option. We can't force our patients to have any test, let alone a blood test. And I certainly wouldn't be forcing children to do it. But I think it's important that we offer it. And I think you'd be surprised that actually some will jump at the opportunity to get a definitive test to prove what's going on. And others will be less keen.
Because some children can find tests like spirometry and pheno super tricky, can't they? They can't coordinate it. They just can't get the hang of it. Have you got any top tips for getting reliable results from small children?
In our practice, we have actually been doing pheno on children as young as 5. And initially, we did have difficulties. But actually, I think that related more to our confidence and our skills in actually helping coach the child to do it. You will always get children between the ages of 5 and 8, and sometimes even older, who can't do a test like pheno or spirometry, but it's worth a try. And actually, the guideline does suggest trying from the age of 5. And I think you'll be surprised at how easy it can be for some children to do.
So maybe there's something there about our confidence as healthcare professionals in expecting good things from our patients, and also coaching them through how to use a pheno machine.
I mean, the pheno machines that we've used are very good at, and then they're quite easy to use. Some people and some children are really good at doing tests. Some are pretty poor, and you're never going to get a good result. But until you try, and until you work out ways in which you can help to coach them through it, you're never going to have the confidence or the skills to do it. So it's important to try, and document if it works. If it doesn't work, we can always try again when they're better. And when you think they'll be able to do it.
I guess this is part of the beauty about having a pheno machine where possible in your clinic room, so that you can seize that opportunity to retest the child when the opportunity arises.
Absolutely. And with a lot of these things, the more you do something, the better you get at it. And that's the same for clinicians helping patients and the patients doing the test as well.
All about the confidence, Andy. Sometimes I'll see a patient, child patient, who is already on treatment for asthma, But when I look back through their notes, I can't find any record of objective testing. And in some cases, there's not even a clear clinical assessment to back up why we've been treating them in the first place. Can I get your advice on how we can manage these patients? If they're on treatment, should we be stopping their treatment and retesting? Or is that a bit risky? What would the guidelines tell us to do in that instance?
Well, firstly, I don't think there's any rationale for going back and testing every single person who hasn't got evidence of tests to prove it. I think if you've got suspicions that they don't have asthma, then it'd be worth weeding them off their treatment and looking to perform these tests going through the algorithm as we've talked about. I think if it's been much more recently, then again, you do have a bit more grounds to actually consider with the patient. Why did we come to this decision? Where's the proof of what they've got going on? But I think for somebody who's had asthma perhaps for 10, 20 years and they're responding well to treatment, we don't need to go back and test them at all.
Right, thank you. Should we move on to these tricky preschoolers? This is a group that tends to make healthcare professionals feel more than a bit anxious. Why do you think that is?
I think there's lots of different reasons. I mean, children are not as good at giving clinical histories, but their clinical history is often a lot more simple, which can make it a lot easier for us rather than adults who have made our own decisions about what they want to tell us, for example. We also do worry about what we're missing with children. We don't want to put a label on somebody and start them on steroids, for example, if they don't have asthma. We feel that those consequences are greater. But similarly, we don't want to miss something and speaking to colleagues, they wonder about missing CF or heart conditions and other really major issues that can affect children as well. But I go back to basics. I've said this a few times already. You take a good clinical history from somebody. If it sounds like asthma, if it's behaving like asthma and the triggers are like asthma, and then you've got other things that point in that direction, like a family history, or they've also got atopy, so eczema or hay fever, then you can be a lot more certain about what's going on. If they've got problems with growth or they've got eating problems or breathing problems at other times, then you might start considering whether there's another condition that could be causing some of their symptoms. So the more people you take a good history from, the more you'll recognise how many fit into the typical box that is asthma. And those that don't will worry you at the time. And they're the ones that you need to be thinking about.
So we have viral-induced wheeze, don't we? So we have wheezy small children. And then we have children with asthma. How can we tell them apart?
It's very difficult. When I first started doing respiratory 20 years ago, I went to a course up in London to listen to some of the world's greatest experts on exactly this topic. And one of their first slides, he basically explained that he still almost tosses a coin on this. He cannot predict which of those wheezy patients have got viral-induced wheeze and which ones have got asthma, because he will be proved wrong over the time. But what he then pointed out was a bit like what I've said, going back to those basics of asking a really good history. If somebody is getting symptoms just when they've got a virus, that is more likely to be viral wheeze. If somebody is getting those symptoms, and there are other times, it might happen with a virus, it might also happen when they're exercising, it might also happen when hay fever levels are high, then you can start thinking this person has got multi-trigger wheeze, which fits more with an asthma pattern than the viral pattern.
That's really useful, because I think what I'm hearing is that small children have small airways, and those airways get readily inflamed when they've got a virus, which makes them wheeze. Is that right?
Absolutely. And because they're small airways, it doesn't take a lot to make them narrow a little bit, which causes noises. When I see people in my duty clinic, every child with a bit of snot and is causing a little bit of wheeze and a little bit of crackles, and it's really hard to tell which part of the airway it's actually coming from. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right with that.
So what we're looking for really is those children who don't just have, as you say, a wheeze every time they get a virus. They've got other things at play, and that's the history that we're looking out for.
However, of course, some people, virus will be their only trigger for their asthma. So it's all about watching them over time. It is about looking for some of those other triggers. And if they're getting lots of episodes, then you might well be trying them on preventative treatment anyway, and you can see how they respond to that. So I think that there's different ways of approaching it.
So it's a kind of watch, treat, wait scenario in this age group, and then we can think about a formal diagnosis down the line.
Exactly right. And I think if you're ever worried, then share the diagnosis with somebody else. Talk to one of the GPs or more experienced people in the practice. Consider an advice and guidance to one of the specialists at the hospital. Share your worries, share any concerns you've got. But actually, if you've taken a good clinical history and you've got some good certainty about what's going on, then you can be confident, but always follow up. Things do change over time or become more obvious over time.
Yeah. So we're saying with these very small children, don't be too afraid. Trust your clinical judgment. Do go and get more help if you're not sure.
Exactly right.
Lovely. So, Andy, we have come to the end of our time together today. Have you got any final words of wisdom for a healthcare professional who might be listening to this and is new to asthma or just generally feeling a bit unconfident and worried about what they should be doing?
I think these guidelines are a really good template for us providing more certainty and better care for our patients. Spend time with colleagues, listen to how they take histories, because taking a good history is really important in this. Go onto the hub, spend some time looking at the webpage there. We've designed them so that there's lots of hints and tips in there to handhold everybody through taking a good history and find out what's going on. Look at other organisations who are providing training as well. PCRS conference, education providers. There's lots of things out there which can help us all to keep up to a good level and keep doing the right things for our patients. And if you're really feeling unconfident and you feel like you're needing some mentorship or support, speak to your local pharma reps, speak to local colleagues, speak to the hospital. There are always people out there who would love to support you to do your job better.
Thanks, Andy. You're not in it alone is the message here, isn't it? That's it for this first episode of the Respiratory Essentials podcast. A huge thank you, Andy, for joining me. Today, we covered the essentials of diagnosing asthma in adults, school-aged children and preschoolers, from history taking to objective tests to correct coding. You can find more detailed tools and patient resources in our Healthcare Professionals Hub. And if you have questions, you can always call our helpline, which is staffed by respiratory specialist nurses, on 0300 222 5800, or you can email us at info@asthmaandlung.org.uk. This was part one of our asthma series. Join us next time as we focus on how to manage asthma in general practice. Thank you for listening.